Welcome everyone to today's webinar with Dr. Bob Martindale. My name is Michael Montalto and I'm Senior Director of Medical Affairs at Metagenic. We are pleased to offer this webinar as part of a collaboration with Dietitians in Integrative and Functional Medicine, which is a specialty practice group of the American Academy. Welcome to all DIFM members. Our speaker today, Dr. Bob Martindale, received his BA and MA degrees from Humboldt State University in Arcata, California. His PhD is from UCLA. And his MD is from George Washington University in Washington, D.C. His surgical residency was completed at Madigan Army Medical Center in Tacoma, Washington. Dr. Martindale is currently Professor of Surgery, Chief of Gastrointestinal and General Surgery, and Medical Director of Hospital Nutritional Service at Oregon Health and Science University in Portland, Oregon. Dr. Martindale has over 250 publications to his credit, including peer-reviewed articles, reviews, chapters, and educational videos. If you have questions for Dr. Martindale, please type them into the Q&A section of the webinar console. We will address as many questions as time will allow after Dr. Martindale's presentation. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Martindale to today's webinar on leaky gut syndrome. Dr. Martindale.
Thank you, Mike, and thanks for all of those that are listening tonight. I know for the East Coast, it's a little late. We were just saying this will probably put you to sleep, so this might be good. So anyway, leaky gut syndrome, you know, it's a very interesting area. You know, and the question always is for us clinicians, is it real? Is there something to it? Is there data for it, data against it? Most people would argue it's related to gut permeability, but we have to really look at what are the prospective randomized trials and what's the hard science evidence to support them. So the question is, if there is something we can do, what is the time and when should we start treating it? And how do we treat it? That's probably even the bigger question. If we look at the definition in Wikipedia, I did this not long ago. It's sort of interesting. It kind of goes through that a lot of people say it's altered damage, lining of the gut, and all sorts of toxins and microbes and undigested food and waste or leak through the bowel wall. And there's been as all of you know well, probably better than I, there's all sorts of diagnoses been associated with it, anything from autism to the various sepsis. And we'll talk a little bit about some of those tonight. If you ask leaders in the area, for example, Don Kirby here, who's chief of GI at Cleveland Clinic, he said, you know, here's his quote, you know, from the MD standpoint, it's very gray area. Physicians don't know enough about the gut in this area. Linda Lee, who's a gastroenterologist at Hopkins, for example, we don't know a lot, but we do know that it exists. And so, you know, I think in the absence of evidence, we don't know what it means or what therapies we can use to address it. And I think that's the general consensus among most clinicians is that, in fact, there is something to it, but what do we do? Now, interestingly enough, it is not recognized by the ICD-9 or the new ICD-10. There's some things in the new ICD-10, which went active on October 1st, that is some data with saying maybe you can pull a couple things at ICD-10 that do commit to this. And say, but basically, the National Health Service in UK does not recognize it as a syndrome. So there's really quite a controversy. You know, if you look at the lay press, it, like I say, it's everything from pathogens to toxins, et cetera, and then that kind of slide on the internet. But if we really look at the GI tract, it's a delicate balance. And I think this key is it's a barrier function and it's a selective absorption. You think about the GI tract, it's really just a big tube running through our bodies. You know, and everything inside the lumen of the bowel is really the external environment. So if you look down at the bottom of that slide there, that's the scanning electron micrograph of a brush border. You can see there's that black line here. Can you guys see my pointer there? Are you seeing my pointer at all? Mike, can you see the pointer? No? Okay, no problem. Anyway, as you see the bottom line, there's a sort of split between the cells. And those little microvilli on top of there, you can see the little microvilli on top. If you think about that, we are one cell layer from enough endotoxin in your human GI tract, in the normal GI tract, one cell, there's enough endotoxin to kill about 500 people. And that's a non-sick person. So the question is, how does the GI tract know what to absorb, what to leave in there, and keep out the toxins while absorbing the nutrients, you know, the amino acids, carbohydrates, micro, macronutrients? So I find that very, very interesting, and you have to think about that, everything we talk about that. We've got all kinds of non-mechanical and mechanical barriers. We've got defense systems which bring tears to the eyes of a Nassau scientist. you know, we got normal gut flora, which we'll spend a lot of time on, secretory IgG, the gut-associated lymphoid tissue, dendritic cells and macrophage cells, which will pick up some of these pathogens and make antigens against them. We've got mechanical barriers there, epithelial barriers, mucus layers, tight junctions, and on and on and on. So we've got plenty of defenses. The question is, what happens when we get some disease state or some of that is lost, some of that barrier function is lost? Well, if we look at the issue there, you can see what it looks like. Microbial diversity plays a big role here. On the left side of the slide, when you've got plenty of bacteria and different species, and we know we've got about 1,500 to 2,000 varieties of bacteria in our GI tract. You know, several division, 9 different divisions, several different phyla, and down to when you talk about species and strains, we're well over a couple thousand. And we know that when we lose that microbial diversity, things start to turn sour. And that seems to be the big key. We know that the enteric nervous system, which is a very well integrated system, plays on that loss of barrier, plays on that presence or absence of the microbiome changes, and then causes all kinds of systemic problems. If you look at the GI tract, remember the enteric nervous system, as you can see in these multiple layers, these are big nerve plexes. But if we look at the enteric nervous system, we know there's 400 to 600 million enteric neurons. That's basically about the same amount that we find in the spinal cord. And this GI tract, enteric nervous system can function autonomously. We see this routinely after spinal cord injury. After 48 to 72 hours, the GI tract sort of takes up on its own and allows propagation and pulsation of food down through the GI tract. So as you can imagine, the relationship between this picking up signals from the lumen of the bowel, from the central nervous system, and from ganglia within the GI tract. So the connection between the nervous system and the GI tract is tremendous. We know that there's all sorts of enteric neuropathies associated with this. For example, Hirschsprung's would be a congenital developmental neuropathy, sporadic or acquired neuropathies, inflammatory bowel disease, and irritable bowel syndrome we know is partially responsible, mainly irritable bowel neuropathy secondary to other diseases, Parkinson's, et cetera, which are central nervous system, obviously dysmotility abnormalities, and then ICU dysmotility. One is induced by either the stress or the whatever happened with their, whatever got them in the ICU. If we look at the diseases associated with leaky gut, I like to divide them up in those that we have very strong support for, those that we have some support, but no good randomized prospective trials, and then ones that we hear is often caused by leaky gut syndrome, but we have no real data for. I have to say, I'm going to move depression over into the SUMS system now, but skin disorders, allergies, fibromyalgia, we don't have a lot of data. You know, so we have to be very, very careful. And absolutely no objective data for, you know, just weight gain, obesity, and chronic fatigue, although we know now that changes in the gut bacteria will cause disease. We know now that obesity, for example, is transplantable by some nice work done in the last 4 years. You can actually take bacteria from an obese male, put in a notobionic animal, an animal with that no bacteria, and they become obese. So it's a very interesting area there. So that's also going to move up into little objective data. Okay, this is just my classification. Now, how do we check this? Well, what happens to the barrier? Do we have good models to check the barriers? Well, you can see here, we've got lots of methods to check. Is the barrier doing what it's supposed to do? None of them are great. I can honestly tell you, we've tried several of these in our labs, and none of these are great. Probably the best one is these claudin proteins, which are the tight junction proteins, the little spot welds in the cells here. And if you can see my pointer, it's a little purple piece on this slide on the right of the cell. Now, if we move on to say, what's the data where we started talking about the leaky gut? Well, actually, Ben Eisman, back in a paper way back in 1977, began to say there's a problem with the loss of the barrier function of the GI tract as the source of multiple organ system failure. Soon after Ben Eisman published this paper in 1977, we started saying, okay, maybe the gut is the motor for multiple organ system failure, that we knew these people were getting sicker and sicker despite broad-spectrum antibiotics. We never really found the issue with it. you know, what was the exact cause. You know, we knew that there was infectious etiology was always suspected. We thought, well, there was an abscess that was undrained, or there was some dead tissue that was not properly removed. But actually, by the 70s, we started to see issues where we started to see data that was actually showing multiple organ system failure without any ongoing infection. And we know that trauma, sepsis, shock, and multiple organ system failure all have very common things of splanchnic hypoperfusion. So when the lack of blood flow, in this case, was probably the source of the loss of the barrier function. When we see this low blood flow to the GI tract, we get mucosal blood flow, barrier disruption, altered GI motility, and changes in the bacterial flora. Those all continue to go in this downhill spiral and so-called continues this motor for multiple organ system failure. Well, and I'm not going to bore you with the data, but the bottom line is we had more and more data saying that we can lose our organ function from gut barrier dysfunction without any ongoing infection. So I think that was the key to say, well, maybe there's more to this than we know. And then we, in about mid-1980s out of Canada, we had this what we call then the gut as the motor for multiple organ system failure. And then people said it was all flow dependent, blah, blah, blah. And you got all these papers, arguments for 15 years as Critical Care Society. But the bottom line is now we strongly believe that bacteria, or even more importantly, the toxins produced by that bacteria, which normally are in that one cell layer thick area that protects us, is now getting into the bloodstream and going to the liver. The data which would support this early on was by Dr. Gene Moore and Fred Moore out of Denver, where they showed shock and hypoperfusion allows gut release of pro-inflammatory cytokines, thereby causing acute respiratory distress or sepsis. Then we showed nice data by Dr. Fink with epithelial tight junctions were compromised. Some more data in germ-free animals were increased survival. Normally, if you do ischemia reperfusion where you stop the blood flow to the intestine for a short time and reperfuse it, they all die, or many of them die of sepsis. But if you take an animal by sterile C-section from the mother, this animal model, and they have no bacteria in their intestine, you can do ischemia reperfusion and 100% survival of those animals. That tells us that that gut bacteria, which we're normally living with, becomes toxic then and becomes your enemy. Okay, so then Dr. Deutsch showed toxin from the gut damages lungs, and then John Alverdi, who continues to work in this area, showing the connections between the bacteria and multiple organ system failure. So I think there's no question that when we lose our barrier, we increase our risk and patients get very sick. Now, most of the time, most of the discussion about leaky gut syndrome is not in the ICU. But I can tell you that's where we've got the data. The data in the ICU is clear now, even up to this nice paper in the Journal of Trauma and Acute Care Surgery 2014, which basically shows we're doing better and everywhere. We're doing better with cardiac support, with pulmonary support, with renal support. But guess what? We're not doing very well with gut barrier support, even up to 2014. We've not really changed much in that area. So then if we go on to say, okay, what are the most commonly reported in the population free living, not in the ICU? Because most, we know the data for the ICU, but most people that talk about, I think I have leaky gut syndrome, are free living. They're out, they just think, and they get bloating, gas, cramping, various food sensitivities, and fatigue. Less commonly, you see things like asthma, chronic joint pain, you know, behavioral changes, constipation, etc. These all are sort of vague and truly very hard to get objective data for. We're starting to get some objective findings with irritable bowel syndrome. There's some interesting, actually, these sort of underwear that have electrodes in them, and you can actually measure the volume of the abdominal cavity by using these electrodes across 15 different electrodes, measure the volume of the abdominal cavity. When people complain of their irritable bowel, you know, which is many people call is cause leaky gut causing it, you can actually measure the volume, but we can't measure things in the bloodstream that show that they're leaking. So what about treatment? You know, what should we tell our patients we think might have leaky gut syndrome? The keys here are maintaining visceral blood flow, so volume, don't let them get dehydrated. Glucose control, we know what a blood sugar greater than 200, we start to see loss of mucosal barrier and rapid changes in the GI flora, which cause disruption of the mucosal barrier. Minimizing pharmaceutical agents, also the motility and the flora. Narcotics, minimizing narcotics, which cause, obviously, dysmotility. Minimizing even PPIs in most cases, proton pump inhibitors or H2 blockers, which we know alter the brush border. And there is some data for pre and probiotic supplements, and we'll talk about that. And then, you know, lowering the inflammatory stimuli, you know, low inflammation type diet, so-called the Mediterranean diet, many people have found to be helpful for leaky gut syndrome. Now, now, what are the mechanisms of this? Well, we know the blood flow to the GI tract is tremendous. 25% of your cardiac output in every heartbeat goes to the GI tract. Normally, about 1.25 liters per minute at rest, and during exercise, that rapidly drops. Or stress. We know that just psychological stress shunts blood flow from the GI tract. And in fact, it goes down to about 0.5 liters per minute with exercise, and I could say there's stress also. With a meal, a single mixed meal, we go from about 1.5 liters a minute, 1.25 liters per minute, to 3 liters per minute. So you can see we rapidly change that. Okay, up to 20 to 30% of your total body oxygen consumption is at rest, is from the GI tract. So in the small intestine is our biggest player here, with 50% of the arterial blood flow going to the splanchnic bed. Okay, villus tips are the highest at risk because of what we call a countercurrent exchange mechanism. And you can see by this picture in the right upper quadrant here, the oxygenated blood going up, and actually you can see it better in the next picture. You can see the oxygenated blood coming up here near the base of it, and as it goes up, the blood, the oxygen and blood take change here, and so the tip of the villus is the most ischemic. The most unoxygenated blood is at the tip of the villus, comes up by the artery, and goes down by the veins. You can see on the right side, you can see the partial pressure of oxygen there. So what happens during times of stress in ICU settings or even, you know, different medications we take, we slough our tips of the villus, as you can see here. And then what happens, the absorption takes place at the tip of the villus, and that's what's affected first. So we see changes in absorption, people get more diarrhea, they get cramping abdominal pain. So then what can we do? Well, we talked about a relatively anti-inflammatory diet base, and that's nicely shown here, that if we have a mixed meal, actually with a little bit higher of fish oil base, you can see it's an anti-inflammatory pathway is activated using the central nervous system. This is a relatively new pathway showing we lower the total inflammation in the lining and the muscularis of the GI tract, okay, if we, in fact, use the early GI tract feeding after various things, this cholinergic anti-inflammatory pathway described first in 2010, but since that time we've got multiple new studies showing this is very active and can decrease the inflammation in the muscularis of the GI tract. So when you think about the GI tract, we have to say in these people that have leaky gut syndrome, it's really an inflammatory process. And how do we regulate that inflammatory process? We can think of the GI tract is if we use it and eat, put the right food in it, we're going to decrease our inflammation. If we don't use it or put the wrong pro-inflammatory things, we're going to increase the inflammation in the GI tract. So generally speaking, that's one method. We know the immune system is huge in the GI tract. In fact, if you take the entire immune system of your body, which we normally think of our classic immune organs, the bone marrow, the spleen, and the lymph nodes, they make up about 2.5 times 10 to the 10th immunoglobulin-producing cells. The GI tract, mouth to anus, 8.5 times 10 to the 10th immunoglobulin-producing cells. So we're, you can see 70% of your body's immune system is basically in the GI tract. Okay. Now, if we look at that, now you say, well, okay, that's great. So our gut-associated lymphoid tissue, but remember, because of these dendritic cells and these macrophage-presenting cells, which then regulate the T cells, we have, because of the connection in the graph on the left here, you can see the antigens in the lumen are picked up by these specialized cells here in Peyer's patches. They present that antigen then to a macrophage or a dendritic cell. They can then travel throughout the body, giving protection in the mucosal-associated lymphoid tissue, the bottom right diagram, and that gives us protection in every epithelial surface, whether it's your lungs, your tears, your liver secretions, your GU secretions. Every tissue basically gets protection by seeing the antigens in the GI tract. So again, if we've lost our mucosal border, these antigens are going to be coming across in various methods, as well as endotoxin paralyzing some of these immune cells. Now, what do we do as clinicians and people that are taking care of patients every day? We give broad-spectrum antibiotics way too much in this country. That's a huge way to disrupt this. Proton pump inhibitors, H2 blockers, vasoactive agents in our hospital patients, opioids. You know, it seems like everybody more is on some kind of opioid, anticholinergic agents, decreased luminal delivery, and then, of course, the psychological stress, which we know now, as we've talked about, alters the gut barrier. So we have this concept then of dysbiosis. This is probably the biggest ongoing thought in this whole concept of just dysbiosis. As you can see, the idea that we alter the flora, causing then the pathogens to outweigh and causing all sorts of epithelial disruption. So let's look for a second at those. Again, post-genetics affects this, lifestyle, early colonization. As we know, that women that give birth via C-section, the kids have a very different flora than kids who were born through normal vaginal delivery. We also give various issues with our various medical practice, all altering the microbiome. And again, just for keeping in mind that this is just a tube flowing through our GI tracts, flowing through our the bodies, we got lots of metabolic functions take place by these bacteria. So let's go through some of those. If we look at those, remembering that the GI tract is about the size, if you spread it out and spread out the microvilli, about the size of a tennis court. Okay, it's about 300 to 400 square meters of surface area. Okay, and we've known for a long time that the microbiome that's there, we know there's a big connection that these concepts are not new. The Bible, the Quran talk about this idea that feeding the gut keeps things healthy, but really the father of our current concept of probiotics comes from Metchnikoff. Metchnikoff won the Nobel Prize, this picture up there in the right upper quadrant, won the Nobel Prize in 1904 for the discovery of the macrophage. He used that money then to travel the world and try to figure out why some populations seem to live longer than others. First ones, he looked in Bulgaria, then he went to Yucatan Peninsula, then he went to North Korea, where there were segments of population where people lived 20 to 30 years longer than the peers around them. And the only thing he could find they all did in common was they all ate some source of lactic acid every day, or butyrate, basically lactobacillus. North Korea, it was kimchi. In Yucatan Peninsula, it was fermented llama milk. In Bulgaria, it was cow's milk in the form of kefir. In some of the areas in the Middle East, they were eating kefir. Again, fermented milk products were usually the case, except obviously North Korea, where they had kimchi. We know that the number of bacterial genes are outnumber us about, 20 to 1, 30 to 1, and the bacteria living in our body outnumber us about 10 to 1, okay, actually 100 to 1. Interestingly enough, if we talk about the probiotics, we know from our first day of life we're exposed to bacteria, okay, and the bacteria then become either good bacteria or bad bacteria. The problems are we continue to evolve. About a third of children in the United States of America are now born by C-section. Over 51% still get some sort of bottle feeding in the first month of life. Major dietary changes have taken place. We know now that the artificial sweeteners, in very nice papers published in 2014 in Nature, one of our best journals, scientific journals, show that clearly the artificial sweeteners in diet drinks are causing metabolic syndrome. If you haven't seen that literature, it'd be a whole new area to talk about for you and to look into. It's fascinating. Changes in our activity, immunization, decrease in parasitic infections, refrigerations, obviously, and even the use of antibiotics, and much of it is not indicated. So all those things are altering our GI physiology and really, in my mind, setting us up for the idea that maybe this is part of the etiology of leaky gut syndrome. We know the microbiome changes very rapidly in your GI tract. Diet. We know that if people eat 12 hours apart, the microbiome changes just in dietary changes over a 12-hour period. This is nice work done by John Alverdi here, who showed that in a trauma setting, within 30 minutes, the bacteria become pathogenic. Your normal this happens to be with E. coli, but he's also done it with Pseudomonas. That within 30 minutes, they're normally living in your intestine, healthy, not causing trouble, no problem at all. And then when you get traumatized or significant amount of stress, whether it be metabolic or surgical stress, the bacteria then change their phenotype of their genes and become aggressive and become pathogenic. That is a very interesting finding in knowing that day to day, our bacteria can change from normal free living in our intestine with no trouble at all to becoming pathogenic. So the question is, can we change it with probiotics? Well, we could spend an hour on any one of the areas here these arrows point to: preventing neoplastic changes, enhancing nutrient utilization, supporting a mucosal barrier. But really today we're looking at leaky gut. So let's just, we're going to talk more about supporting mucosal barrier, regulating systemic immune function, regulating bowel, and regulating inflammation. So that's really the leaky gut concept. Again, probiotics, I'm sure you all know, understand that they're live microorganisms that by World Health Organization definition confer health benefits to the host, okay? Prebiotics, then, are substrates for the probiotics that should become fermented, okay? Now, we know that the in human milk and really in all mammalian milk, there's these milk oligosaccharides. We know for a fact that 15% of the sugar in breast milk is not able to be absorbed by the child in the proximal small bowel. It's specifically put there as fermentable substrate for the bacteria in your GI tract. So the Mother Nature has given us the sort of the perfect food, right? We give it to the child, 80 to 85% of it is absorbed as a nutrient source. Those other specific bacteria, which are not absorbed in the proximal gut, go into the GI, go into the distal gut, usually distal small bowel, proximal colon, where they ferment, producing short-chain fatty acids, which make the optimal growth for protective bacteria to protect that child from early childhood diseases. So I think, again, very interesting that we've learned that 15% of that energy produced by that child doesn't even get absorbed in the proximal gut, but is made to support those bacteria. Lots of mechanisms here. You can see this is six mechanisms on this slide. And this is just showing that we've got data now to support these, inhibiting other bacteria, enhancing mucosal barrier. You know, you can see inhibiting pathogen production, modulating the immune system, multiple things. And I put this slide up just to show that not that there's actually some science to this, not just sort of hocus pocus. Okay, there's multiple other mechanisms described, which we won't go into today. But for example, butyrate, which is one of the primary substrates which is produced from the bacterial fermentation of those carbohydrates we talked about, enhances neutrophil killing, actually increases the ability of your macrophages when they've been seen by these short-chain fatty acids, enhance their ability to kill pathogenic bacteria, and numerous others. You know, this slide I put up just to show you that we actually have science down to the specific receptor in the cell membrane. This outer loop here is the cell membrane. These are various receptors there. We know that, for example, if you have lactobacillus rhamnosus present, you decrease the response to a toxic stimuli to the cell membrane, which then would give a pro-inflammatory cytokine. So lactobacillus rhamnosus, through multiple very well-described pathways now, can decrease inflammation at the nuclear level. What about in preventing colonization? As you can see, these two petri dishes on the bottom here showing us lactobacillus reuteri inhibiting Staph aureus. On the left there, lactobacillus reuteri inhibiting H. pylori. Remember, H. pylori in the world is the number one cause of gastric cancer. So I think we can see very nicely that these protect us from gastric cancers. What about enhancing the body from stress from other epithelial damage? You can see here that lactobacillus rhamnosus, GG, in this case, gives us protection by causing expression of heat shock protein. When lactobacillus GG is present, we increase the colon's development of heat shock protein, which protects the cell from subsequent stress. These are, again, just mechanisms. Look at the blood flow here in this. Going from left to right, on the left side here is a germ-free animal. On the right side is a Bifidobacterium theta, a 50-fold increase in blood flow when you give animals back the correct bacteria. They're very nice. Now, what about protection of our brush border, preventing the leaky gut syndrome? For example, here we have Lactobacillus salivarius, which presents disruption. If you look at this graph here with all the green little nets on them, the control group is on the left-hand side, okay? That's a control with non-injured animal. If you give the animal hydrogen peroxide, which we know is a very strong oxidant, it oxidizes those brush borders, and you can see we start to see loss of the mucosal integrity. We start to see a leaky gut. But if we have, in the presence of UC-118, very nicely protects us from that oxidant injury to the gut. So again, this is produced by a bacteria, Lactobacillus salivarius. We know how that works now. We know that it causes reformation of those tight junctions which you saw destroyed from the hydrogen peroxide. So if it's present, we get reassembly of these tight junctions, thereby protecting the cell from loss of mucosal integrity. But we have to remember these are strain-specific effects. We can't just say that all bacteria work. These are strain-specific effects. And when we start prescribing probiotics to patients, we need to know what we're treating and what's the data to support that. I was the chairman of the Critical Care Guidelines Committee, and we made the big point that just came out for the Critical Care Society. We did not recommend routine use of probiotics in the ICU unless we have data to support. So our goal there and our guideline, which will be out next month, it's the second edition, says we agree and we support the use of probiotics, but only where data supports that. So I think that's what you have to look at. Here's our short chain fatty acids in enhancing white blood cell function. You can see this is an actual scanning electron micrograph. In the center there, it looks like some sort of monster. That little green thing right there in the middle of the slide, at the bottom of the slide, is an E. coli bacteria. And that macrophage is attacking that E. coli and will engulf it. Now you say, okay, what's that got to do with short-chain fatty acids? We know that when short-chain fatty acids produced by the fermentation of the gut, it enhances that macrophage function and increases the ability of those cells to kill the bacteria. Here's just more data. We don't need to worry too much about the short-chain fatty acid stuff because we can see. So there's many other mechanisms, and you can see the bottom of this slide here is that the interaction with the enteric nervous system. We know this is a bidirectional communication. We can, if there's lactobacillus present, we get nerve growth factor. We increase IL-10. If there, IL-10, remember, is the anti-inflammatory cytokine with bacteria present, the right bacteria. So you can see multiple mechanisms there involved. And these are all pretty much 2013, 2014 rated, even some 15. So now let's look at all the things we can address in the current world about probiotics. All of these things here we have data for, but today we're just looking at leaky gut. So let's kind of focus on that. As I mentioned before, that H. pylori infection, you know, the number one gastric cancer cause in the world, it also causes ulcer diseases in this country as well as others. Okay, what happens here when you use Lactobacillus reuteri in this phase? We disrupt the H. pylori, which is attached to the gastric cell, causing chronic inflammation. We put in Lactobacillus reuteri in the middle of the gate, and it displaces some of the H. pylori from the parietal cells in the stomach, the mucosal lining. So you can see, look at all these effects. This is H. pylori, you know, eradication therapy with and without probiotics. Look at this. You can see with probiotics, 85% versus 75%. Side effects, 22 versus 38. Many people argue that H. pylori is the classic leaky gut cause. It causes inflammation of the mucosa and causes all kinds of dyspepsia, irritable, you know, sort of cramping, bloating, gas feeling. And look at this, when you use it with and without lactobacillus, look at all the symptoms, how they get better. Across the board, everything you can look at gets better. Probiotics and irritable bowel syndrome, you know, again, a little bit iffy, I have to tell you, but there's interesting. There's plenty of papers out there now. When we look at them, you've got to look at these very objectively, and it's hard to find objective outcome parameters with the irritable bowel. But you can see if you look at and break them up into bispecific bacteria, there's 24 studies in abdominal pain, prospective randomized studies you can see, and here's the bacteria involved. Abdominal distension and bloating, we've got 18 prospective randomized trials. You can see those bacteria involved. And increased flatulence and gas production, you can see there's been 10 good studies. The only one that hits all of these symptoms is actually Bifidobacterium brevi, but you can see the individual species here affecting the different issues which you're talking about. And inflammatory bowel, the bottom line here is there is no data to support it. The good news is no harm is ever, but we can't really, despite over 31 studies now, this slide says 29, there's 31 studies, you know, 16 prospective randomized trial, basically we can't show significant benefit. What about fatty liver? We know this is a big issue, hepatic steatosis or non-alcoholic hepatosteatitis. You can see, we know that loss of the brush border clearly allows endotoxin to cross and causes inflammation in the liver, NASH, non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. Metabolic syndrome, we've got pretty much the same thing, you know, this hyperglycemia, mild hyperglycemia, hypertension, and obesity, that combination, you can see they get hypertension. Now, what about changing the microbiome causing weight loss? Is there any data to support that? Well, look at this. It's very interesting here. This is a study which correlated the amount of antibiotics given in the first year of life with the amount of obesity. As you can see here, this is antibiotic prescriptions on the right side in the blue per 1,000 persons, and this is obesity trends in the U.S. in 2010. You could almost overlay those pictures. Well, not only was this study done showing the association, they went back and looked at children who got antibiotics in their first year of life for those that didn't, and they looked at them at 5 years later in kindergarten, and sure enough, the children who got antibiotics during their first year of life had more obesity when they were in kindergarten than those who didn't get antibiotics the first year of life. So are we setting our kids up by destroying the normal microbiome early in life and setting them up later for obesity? We know that altering the diversity, this is taken here, you can see bacterial diversity. We know that obese people have fewer bacteria varieties in their gut than those that are heavy. We know that, in fact, obesity is transplantable. So they took sterile mice, as I talked about before, so-called notobiotic mice, and they took identical twins who were raised as they grew older. One became obese and one became thin. So these are identical twins. They took the stool from the heavy twin and gave it to these mice that have no bacteria and showed they got obese. They took the stool from the skinny thin or the lean man, the male, and gave it to these are human studies, giving to a mouse, notobiotic mouse, no change in their fat mass. So we now have proven nicely, this is in 2013 Science, showing that obesity is in fact transplantable. Again, we talked about diversity, what happens. We give antibiotics. We see a rapid increase in Clostridium difficile production today. And as we all know, Clostridium difficile is a major problem. What about antibiotic-associated diarrhea? This is the great paper. This what in my hospital got a lot of my clinicians interested. As you can see here, 82 clinical trials published in 2012 in Journal of American Medical Association, 11,000 patients. Probiotics confer significant decrease in antibiotic-associated diarrhea, P less than 0.001. Dramatic difference. Same thing for C. diff. We know that we alter the colonic mucosa. You can see there. And again, what happens, we know this is 30,000 lives last year were taken by Clostridium difficile. We know the issue is related clearly to antibiotics. And what do? We now know that taking probiotics can prevent them. This, the Annals of Internal Medicine, the best internal medicine journal they published today, 2012, 28 studies, 4,000 patients. Giving it when you start your antibiotic, giving probiotic decreases the incidence of Clostridium difficile by 66%. This is pennies a day. We can give probiotics for pennies a day, either as in a yogurt or a kefir or as a pill if you want. But remember, as I mentioned earlier with the Lactobacillus salivarius, we've got to have the right bacteria. You can't just give any bacteria. You know, this is a good study showing, okay, they're going to look at antibiotic-associated diarrhea in a multi-center randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial, 17,000 patients, and showed if you give just a standard yogurt, you basically do not get the change. So you've got to get a probiotic yogurt, which we know has effect on the mucosa. So as we finish up in the last couple of slides here, what can we say? We know that probiotics help us in leaky gut, but we've got to find the right probiotic. We know there's certain species that are better, but it's now being looked at for neurologic disorders. I was recently in Africa for the World Health Organization. It's now being used for AIDS prevention. We know that Lactobacillus jensenii actually decreases the uptake to the mucosal cell in the vagina if you have Lactobacillus jensenii present. It blocks the receptor, decreases the viral uptake by the macrophage. Cancer prevention, you can see all sorts of GI surfaces. You know, and as we move along there, dysbiosis, when we know these people in the ICU, this is a paper just published a couple months ago, they took people that were dying of overwhelming sepsis, no other treatment. They'd been given multiple antibiotics, they were still dying. To meet criteria, they had to have sepsis for more than 21 days, I believe, without getting better. They gave these people then stool transplantation, and you can see fecal microbiota for sepsis. Guess what? Most of those people then got better. Septic symptoms resolve rapidly. Stool microbiome changes within 7 days. Inflammatory markers rapidly improved. That was just published in Critical Care in 2015. So the future will be the specific design of probiotics to give for a treatment. So where do we stand now with leaky gut syndrome? I think there's growing data to support loss of integrity of the GI tract is vital to these diseases we've listed here. Clearly, the science is for multiple organ systems. Growing data for irritable bowel, inflammatory bowel, chronic kidney disease. You say with that association we're going to talk about during questions. Obesity, I've added diabetes now. There's very good data showing if you've got, you change the flora to the right sort of flora in your GI tract, your insulin sensitivity goes up dramatically. Current management, you know, what do you say, dietary changes, microbiome consideration, always keep that in mind, controlling that barrier function. But remember, we've got to have data before we can just start saying, oh, they've got leaky gut. Let's just treat them. We need to find data and go from there. Well, thank you very much, and I'm happy to entertain some questions now if you would like.
Thank you very much, Bob. We do have a number of questions. And,
okay.
We'll go ahead and I'll get you started on a few of them. Could you comment on the use of antibiotics during critical care and their potential impact on the incidence of leaky gut in that critical care setting and in standard practice?
Well, it's very interesting. You know, we've gone full circle. You know, that I lived through the last 30 years doing critical care, and we went from everybody got huge broad-spectrum antibiotics. In fact, we went through in the mid-80s and the idea of sterilizing the gut. We gave 3 non-absorbable bacterial, you know, antibiotics and antifungal agents as a fourth. So we gave 4 antimicrobial agents for fungus and bacteria. The idea that if we can sterilize the GI tract, which you can never do, we can maybe decrease our infections and multiple organ system failure, never shown to hold up. The Europeans kind of held on to that for a little longer than we did. So now we've gone the other way. In our ICU, virtually everybody in the ICU gets antibiotics. We give probiotics down their NG tube. So we have a local yogurt, which is a probiotic yogurt, which has got Lactobacillus rhamnosus, Lactobacillus casei, and Lactobacillus plantarum, and we put that down the NG tube as a kefir twice a day in the ICU and anybody. In the hospital, we give it to them on their trays.
That's great. There's a question here relative to the study you mentioned regarding artificial sweeteners, and the person's asking, where is that from? I can help you with that.
Yeah, that was in Nature. That was published in Nature, and if you just go to Google or PubMed and put in artificial sweeteners and metabolic syndrome, you'll get a litany of papers, but the best one is the published in Nature. That's a very nice prospective randomized trial with multiple control groups.
Right, and I can add a little color commentary to that. That was by Suez, S-U-E-Z. It was the October 9th edition of Nature, 2014.
Boy, how'd you find that so fast? That was good. I couldn't remember which month it was.
Well, I was looking while you were talking.
Oh, good. Okay, great.
Yeah. The question here about baby formula, what do you think about baby formula affecting gut bacteria of infants?
Well, it's interesting. We do have some data. And, you know, the first FDA-approved use of probiotics in kids was Lactobacillus rudii for that very reason. You know, normally the time we bring probiotics to market, or people bring probiotics to market as a medical food. It doesn't have to go through the FDA as far as getting a prospective, but they actually did that. Hopkins, Pepe Saavedra, and when he was at Hopkins, to looking at rotavirus prevention in kids, and got the probiotic approved as a drug. Very interesting data. And so I think that formula is the best we can do, but obviously the breast is the way to go. But if you can't, formula is okay. I think it's better than it used to be. We've got a lot more fish oils in it now than we used to have. We've got the appropriate trace mineral. They've now tried to formulate it like breast milk. They'll never match breast milk, but it's the best they can do. So, you know, obviously if you can do breast, great. If not, well, you can take the second best. But there is data to support use of probiotics in babies, especially in these ultra preemies now. There's data that necrotizing enterocolitis in these little kids. You can actually prevent necrotizing enterocolitis in children by adding probiotics to their formulas that they have to give these little babies. And that's very good data. In fact, the most recent of maternal fetal medicine shows that is pretty much a standard of care now, giving probiotics to kids to prevent necrotizing enterocolitis in the babies.
Okay, thank you, Bob. There's another question here. Can someone take too many probiotics in supplemental form?
That's a great question. Probably, You know, as most Americans, if one is good, two is better, and 10 must be great, you know, we all kind of think that way. I've not heard of that problem, but there are cases. There's been 32 cases of valvular heart disease induced by probiotics, lactobacillus, growing on a heart valve, usually from injured valves from prior surgery or from sclerotic valves from atherosclerosis or prior strep injury. So, but the good news is none of those people died from that because you give antibiotics. Lactobacillus are very sensitive to antibiotics, so you can take that. There's been 5 or 10 cases now of reported hepatic abscesses from lactobacillus, usually in transplanted livers who have altered circulation. But most of the time, it's pretty safe. Probiotics are pretty safe. But I'm sure you can take too much.
Okay.
That would be billions, though, because, you know, go ahead. I was just going to say, you know, one thing of some of these probiotic yogurts have 80 or 90 billion bacteria. So usually you'd have to take a lot.
Okay, thank you. You mentioned that diversity of the gut microflora is highly advantageous for gut health. What do you recommend to support gut diversity from a practical perspective?
I think a very mixed diet with various types of fibers, you know, soluble fibers. You know, some beans, some, you know, different vegetables and fruits have different types of fibers. And we know some are better than others, what they call resistant starches or some. Whole grains have various fibers in them. So I think a good mixed diet, a variety of things in your diet increases. Very interesting. They just studied some people very deep in the Amazon jungle that supposedly had no contact with Western civilization. But when you talk to the guys, they show you pictures of them, and one guy's got a Nike shirt on, so clearly he was attached to Western society somehow. But anyway, one of these little kids. But they look at the stool of those people that had no contact with Western society. They have over 2,500 species, up to 5,000 species in their colon. People from America, basically living in the U.S., eating a normal Western diet, have anywhere from 1,500 to, you know, 1,100 to 1,500. Now that that's using 16S ribosomal subunit gene typing, so we can get very nice numbers. But the same testing material, someone living a primitive diet, eating nuts and fruits and berries and occasional little meat once in a while, will have up to 5,000 different species in their gut. So variety seems to be protective against a lot of these diseases.
Okay, thank you, Bob. So there's a question here that says, what bacterial strains are recommended to treat C. difficile infection? And I'd like to also ask you to comment on the protocol that you use at Oregon Health Sciences and University to reduce the incidence of C. diff.
Okay. Our protocol is to start when the patient starts the antibiotic or even before if possible, is to put, if they have in the ICU setting, we give it down the NG tube. On the floor, we give it as a yogurt or a kefir. Now, we do have some pills. Some of the residents like to write more for the pills, but basically everybody that gets an antibiotic in this hospital should be getting some sort of probiotic with it. And I'm happy to send that if you can arrange that. I'm happy to send our protocol out. I have a copy. I send hundreds of them out. It's pretty easy, okay, basically, starting the protocol as soon as you can.
Right. So for those on the line, on the webinar, Dr. Martindale, presented a program at Aspen last year, and the protocol is on the Metagenics Education website. And if you go on to the mhicn.com, you have to log in and register, go under Digestive Health, and you'll see Bob's presentation as well as the protocol. Okay, there's a question. Can you clarify what you mean by a probiotic yogurt? What does that mean to be probiotic yogurt?
Yeah, well, you know, some of the yogurt, by definition in the United States, any yogurt sold has to have lactobacillus, thermophilus, streptophilus, and bulgaricus. I think that's the three. Those don't have a lot of probiotic action. In other words, they have not proven to be a benefit to the host. Now, they'd be of nutritional benefit, obviously, or whatever, but those have live bacteria, but not necessarily a benefit to the host. And by definition, a probiotic has to show, it had to been proven to have benefit to the host. So then most of the probiotic yogurt companies or kefir companies will add things like Lactobacillus rhamnosus or Lactobacillus plantarum or Lactobacillus casei or Lactobacillus reuteri. Those probiotics have been shown to have benefit to the host in various conditions. So those, the big six, I would say today, where we have the most good science for. Now, there's lots of other things, and they're probably good, but if we look at the ones we have got very good science for, I would say rhamnosus, these are for lactobacillus, rhamnosus, KCI, plantarum, salivarius, and which are ruteri. And then there's some bifidobacterium species, which have some different ability to cause things. For example, this routine one that they sell in the grocery store, Activia. That's Bifidobacterium regularis, and there's 16 prospective randomized trials looking at Bifidobacterium regularis and enhancing bowel motility. 11 of the 16 are positive. So, again, depending on the design, we're going to see some different answers. So you have to sort of pick your probiotic and what you're trying to do.
Right. As you mentioned, genus, species, and knowledge of the strain is very vital to that process.
Yeah, and the good thing nowadays is you can just push into PubMed and just say Lactobacillus salivarius, for example, and you'll get where the science is. And if, you know, when you do that and you don't get any science, I'd say, we probably can't prove this one.
Okay. So, Bob, there's a question here about the use of alcohol, what that might do to the microbiome. Any insights on that?
Well, we know in alcoholic cirrhosis with a bad liver, the microbiome is dramatically altered. I don't know, to be honest with you, just what a drink or two would do. I don't have any data on that. That's a good question. You know, now we know that, interestingly enough, some of the resveratrol in red wine seem to be increase a variety of species. Now, whether it's a resveratrol or something else in a red wine, I don't really know. But alcohol doesn't cause death of the bacteria, per se, because by the time it gets to the colon, that alcohol is gone. Now, it does change gastric flora slightly, but I don't have any hard data that's that harmful. It's just a moderate amount to the bacteria.
Okay, thank you. There are a number of questions here on how one diagnoses leaky gut. And I know you covered that in the very beginning. It's hard to diagnose, but maybe you could reply to that simply.
Yeah, I mean, I could tell you, I wish I had a good definition. There's a paper that's referenced on one of the slides. Now, what they have access, Mike, to the slides? To the, look at the slides on the website? Or something.
So, yes, all of this will be archived on Medigenics, www.mhicn.com, probably early next week.
You can see on slide number 2, I think it is. Yeah, slide number 2 that's referenced by Oldenwald in Clinical GI and Hepatology 2013. That's a very nice article that methodically goes through where we are on diagnosis. And the bottom line to that article basically says we don't have a good marker unless you're measuring bacteria in the portal vein, which is almost impossible. And so in the ICU, you can do it because you have access to different lines. But for the routine guy in the clinic, it's a clinical diagnosis based on history and physical exam.
Okay. Going through the questions here, some of them you've already answered. So they're looking for a little more direction on how to choose the appropriate probiotic to support gut health. What parameters do you recommend one look at?
Yeah, I would say see what the disease is, because I think the best treatment for leaky gut syndrome is to treat the disease. So figure out what the disease is, and the leaky gut may or may not be the cause. So sort of out what's going on, is it dysmotility, is it cramping, bloating, irritable bowel, whatever. And then try to treat that disease as best we can. And you can look on the internet and say, okay, I think this is causing irritable bowel. So look up probiotics and irritable bowel, and you'll get a 500 articles. So look up, I would just say go to a review article in the last year or so and see what the latest data is in a high-quality journal. And that's how I would look up. If I'm not sure which probiotic works for different diseases, like now we're starting to look at this obesity issue. Is there some probiotic which can help us with decreasing obesity? And it looks like there are a couple out there now that seem to be a show. Lactobacillus rhamnosus and GG. Lactobacillus gasseri right now probably has the best association. So that, I think, we don't, because there's so many probiotics out there now, which ones specifically for specific diseases, you really just got to look them up. We'd be here forever if I tried to name some, because I'd have to look them up myself.
No problem. So we have about 6 minutes left on the program. And we have a number of questions. I will not be able to get to all of them. I apologize. Let me go as quickly as I can here. What's your thoughts, Bob, on using a low-dose steroid to calm down gut inflammation and allow the gut to heal in addition to using probiotics?
Yeah, in general, steroids are harmful. They inhibit inflammation, but they also inhibit resolution of inflammation. I think that's a real problem today, is like things like Motrin, the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, they're great for anti-inflammatory, but they also stop the pro-resolution side. We're now learning a lot about inflammation. We know that macrophages, which are sort of neutrophils and macrophages, would sort of set off the inflammation. We now know that macrophages could be of the M1 macrophage class or the M2 macrophage classes. Things like Motrin and lidocaine and steroids maintain, they do stop inflammation by lowering M1 macrophage function, but they don't allow transition to the M2 class. Normally, when there's been inflammation, the transition takes place when the M1s turn to M2. M2 are responsible for resolution of inflammation, decreasing edema in the tissues, and that sort of thing. We know that we inhibit that translation to M2 class. So I would not use, in inflammatory bowel, sometimes we have to use steroids to get control of the significant inflammation. But we try not to, and I would not recommend low-dose steroids in most cases to decrease the inflammation.
Okay, thank you, Bob. There's a question here regarding the use of a supplement as a probiotic. Is it best taken with food or in between meals, or does it really matter relative to bioavailability?
I usually recommend taking with food. We just finished a trial here where we actually took a yogurt, which was a non-probiotic yogurt, and we added a probiotic bacteria to it, we had the people then take it as a pill or in yogurt. Saying, is it better to give it with meal and other proteins and other bacteria, even though they're not probiotic bacteria? And the viability of the probiotic that got to the stool, that we measured the probiotic in the stool, was much better when we gave the pill with a meal or we gave the yogurt containing, as part of a meal. The viability to the colon, because that's what you want. Remember, the gastric acid and bile has a major player when it comes to destroying some of those probiotics. Because bile is more toxic than the acid is, actually. Because remember, most of these are lactic acid producers, so acid doesn't really bother lactobacillus that much. It's the bile that tears up the lactobacillus. So it has to get through the stomach and the small bowel to get to the colon, which is where the action is for these probiotics, distal small bowel and colon. And that's where we talk about leaky gut, really.
There's an interesting question here related to pancreatic cancer with the diagnosed H. pylori infection. Will probiotics possibly help decrease symptoms of H. pylori infection?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the data is good. That one slide there that talks about, there's no question. H. pylori, we can decrease the incidence of H. pylori, and we can decrease the symptoms of H. pylori with the probiotics. What was that about pancreatic cancer?
The question was, pancreatic cancer with diagnosed H. pylori beginning chemo as treatment, might probiotics be helpful in that situation?
I don't know about with chemo. I know that's immune suppressive, so H. pylori has a tendency to increase. But generally speaking, I've not seen any contraindication to probiotics, even with chemo and pancreatic cancer, even though they're immunosuppressed. It shouldn't be a problem. Even with cisplatin based, probably gemcitabine.
Okay, thank you. But there's a question, a reference for which good bacteria match up to benefits from a systems perspective. And I don't know what you have in mind for that topic. I'm just going to make a comment to the people that if you go to ISAP, International Society for Pre- and Probiotics, there's a fabulous free PDF on how to select a probiotic and prebiotic for patients. And I don't know if you have anything more to add to that, but that's a great resource.
Oh, that sounds great.
But we're at the top of the hour now. Do you have any closing comments you'd like to share with the folks on the line?
No, I just think that, I think the concept was thought 10 years ago, people thought, oh, this leaky gut, there's no data to support this. I think today there's plenty of data to support leaky gut. I think we know it well in the ICU, whether it's the toxins or actually the bacteria, probably doesn't matter. The end effect is pro-inflammatory state. So I think there's lots of data now that whether it's mild lethane causing irritable bowel or whether it's the ICU patient down in Mold Fork, it's just a failure. We've got to protect our brush border any way we can, enhancing mucosa, good glucose control, maintaining a healthy diet, and a good, you know, in a disease state, try maybe a probiotic combination. Thank you for listening, everybody. I hope I didn't put you to sleep there. There's folks on the East Coast, it's already 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock now.
Okay, thank you very much, Bob, and thank you to all the different members. This was a well-attended webinar. We greatly appreciate it, and have a good evening. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.